HMS Destiny's larboard side belched flame and smoke. She had closed to within less than 50 yards of St. Adolfo before she anchored, and the air trapped between the two ships was a fiery maelstrom as her broadside fired for the first time. A quarter of her company lay dead or wounded before she fired her first shot, and even as Aplin Armach shouted the command, a 25-pound round shot cut through her mainmast 3 feet above the deck. The mast toppled into the smoke like a weary tree, and rigging parted, broken ends lashing out, flailing like maddened serpents. Men who got in the way of that heavy, tired cordage were swatted casually from their feet, usually with broken bones and torn flesh, and others scrambled madly for safety as the entire massive complex of the mainmast came thundering down. The fore topgallant mast followed it, and the galleon staggered as if she'd just lost her rudder all over again. But the men on her larboard guns ignored the chaos and confusion. They paid no heed to the damage control parties racing to cut away the wreckage and drag the injured and dying out of the tangles of fallen cordage. They were totally focused on their guns, for this was the reason Destiny had taken so much damage. This was what she had come to do, and as they heard the youthful ensign's familiar voice, they did it. Ernesto Plysik saw the Carisian mainmast start to topple and opened his mouth to cheer. But before he could, the smoke between the two ships lifted on a fresh furnace blast, and this one didn't come from his guns. The deck hammered against the soles of his shoes. It was the first time he'd ever felt heavy shot striking a ship, and a corner of his mind recognized the difference between the recoil from his own guns and the sharper, lighter, and yet somehow more vicious shock of enemy fire. And then 16 of the 18 shells which had struck his ship exploded almost simultaneously. "Reload! Reload!" Aplin Armach heard the gun captain's shouted commands and looked around, trying to find Lieutenant Simke to take over the larboard battery. But then something smacked him sharply on the shoulder. "Go, Hector!" His head whipped around as Admiral Yearly smacked his shoulder a second time. "Go!" the Admiral repeated, and actually smiled. "Captain Lethick can have you back for the moment." "Aye, aye, sir." The ensign leapt into the disciplined madness, knowing better than to disrupt the choreographed training by shouting unnecessary orders. Instead, he watched the gun crews, his eyes trying to be everywhere at once, ready to intervene if something went wrong. But nothing went wrong. Destiny's gunners had trained for 2 hours every day during their weary voyage from Tellersburg to Ithria. They'd polished old skills and learned new ones as they grappled with the novel concept of exploding shells. And Aplin Armach watched as the number 2 on each gun removed and pocketed the lead patch, protecting the fuse before the shell was loaded. The fuse times had been set by Peter Winkester, Destiny's gunner, before the ship ever cleared for action. And at the end of the action, the number 2 on each gun would be required to hand over those patches as proof the shells had been properly prepared for firing. "Run out! Run out!" One by one, the galleon's surviving guns were brought back to battery, and gun captains all along the line raised their left hands, right hands gripping the firing lanyards. Captain Plysik clawed his way up from his knees, shaking his head like a dazed prize fighter while he tried to make his brain work. He didn't know what had hit him, and he probably never would, but he was pretty sure whatever it was had broken his right shoulder blade. And even at that, he realized, he was better off than his ship. Smoke, much of it wood smoke now, not just powder smoke, streamed from shattered holes ripped through St. Adolfo's timbers and planking. Some of those holes looked big enough for a man to walk through. They weren't, of course, but they looked huge compared to the much smaller holes round shot punched through a ship. Splintered and broken wood was everywhere. Torn canvas and severed lengths of rigging littered the deck. He heard voices screaming in mingled agony and terror, and at least half the midship's upper deck 12-pounders had been knocked over like toys. The bulwark in front of them was simply gone. The deck edge looked like a cliff shattered by a hurricane, and he realized three or four of the Corisian's infernal shells must have impacted almost together to produce that damage. But there was plenty of other damage to go with it, and someone grabbed him, dragging him bodily out of the way as his galleon's mizzenmast came thundering down. "Fire!" somebody screamed. "Fire in the cable tier!" Plysik staggered back to his feet once more, wondering who had just saved him from being crushed by the falling mast. But it was an almost absent thought, lost in the terrifying thought that his ship was on fire. "Away, firefighting parties!" he bellowed, and the seamen who were detailed for that very purpose went rushing below with buckets of water and sand. "Langhorne! She can't take much more of this," he thought. "She..." "Fire!" Hector Aplin Armach shouted. Destiny's second broadside smashed into St. Adolfo like an avalanche. But this was an avalanche of iron and fire and a deadly freight of gunpowder. The 6-inch shells slammed through the Desnarian planking, and this time all of them exploded. One of Ensign Aplin Armach's shells exploded almost directly under Ernesto Plysik's feet, and for him the fate of his ship became forever moot.
8. Duke Colman's office, Port of Ithria, Empire of Desnare. Dabin Barat watched in stony-eyed silence as the two officers in Corisian uniform were ushered through the door of his office. "Your Grace, Admiral Sir Duncan Yearley and his Flag Lieutenant Ensign Aplin Armach," their guide, Captain Bernardo Ferrier, told him. "Admiral Yearley, His Grace, the Duke of Colman." Yearley and his ensign were immaculate, looking as if they'd dropped by for a state dinner, Colman thought bitterly. Ferrier was another matter. His uniform was torn and filthy, reeking of powder and wood smoke. His expression was grim, tight, and strained, but he was lucky to be alive. His ship, Holy Langhorne, had taken fire, burned to the waterline, and sunk under the devastating Corisian assault. She was scarcely the only Desnarian galleon that had happened to, and from the look of things, Ferrier had spent some time in the water before he'd been recovered by the victors. He had obviously done what he could to straighten his hair, wash his hands, wipe the powder grime from his face, but the contrast between him and the two faultlessly attired Corisians' dress uniforms could not have been sharper. Or more deliberate, the Duke reminded himself as he realized he could even smell the Corisian flag officer's fresh cologne. Yearley must have made damn sure the two of them would be as neat as pins. He obviously recognizes the value of setting the stage properly. "Admiral," he made himself say, his tone courteous but cold, and bowed very slightly in greeting. "Your Grace," Yearley responded with an even slighter bow, and Coleman's jaw tightened at that abbreviated bow's subtle insult to his aristocratic rank. Of course, it was possible. Possible it hadn't been Yearley's intention to do any insulting. Then again, "Before anything else," he said, "allow me to express my personal thanks for High Admiral Rockpoint's message about Baron Jarrus. I'm sure I speak for the High Admiral when I say you're most welcome, Your Grace," Yearley said. "I regret the severity of the Baron's wounds, but my understanding is that, barring any unforeseen complications, the healers are confident he'll recover in time." And once he learns how to write left-handed, Coleman thought harshly. But at that, he's lucky to be alive. And maybe the fact that he's lost an arm will help protect him when Clintan gets word of this.
"I hope you're right," he said out loud. "However, I doubt you came ashore just to tell me my brother-in-law is likely to survive."
He showed his teeth briefly. "Somehow, I don't think you're likely to tell me the same thing about my navy." "With the exception of the floating batteries at the western end of Baron Jarrah's line, I'm afraid all your ships have struck," Yearly said gravely. And despite the way he braced himself internally, Coleman flinched visibly. At least the Carizian hadn't said, "All your surviving ships have struck," although that would have been more accurate. According to Coleman's most recent report, 19 galleons and 12 of the floating batteries had burned, blown up, burned and blown up, or simply sunk as the result of battle damage. He didn't know how many of the others were damaged or how badly, and he didn't even want to think about the human cost. But he knew it had been huge. For that matter, he'd sent over 1,000 replacements into the maelstrom before he'd accepted he was simply incurring additional casualties in a lost cause. All the fortifications on Sickle Shoal and Triangle Shoal had also surrendered, although they hadn't hauled down their flags until they'd taken massive damage. That was what the report said, at least, and Coleman had no reason to doubt them, especially since only one of the four fortress commanders, General Stackale, inevitably, was still alive and unwounded. Those accursed bombardment ships were also why they'd lost so many of the floating batteries. The conventional Carizian galleons had declined to venture into the shoal water beyond the main shipping channel to engage them, but the bombardment ships had taken up positions where the batteries' guns couldn't reach them and started dropping those damned exploding shells on top of them. Their percentage of hits hadn't been high, but every hit they had scored had been devastating. Of course, that word, devastating, pretty much summed up the entire battle, didn't it? Once the eastern end of Jarrah's line was blasted out of the way, the Carizians had poured galleons through the gap. They doubled the line of Desnarian ships, sailing along it and engaging it from both sides, pouring their accursed exploding shells into their victims. They hadn't bothered to anchor the way the ships who had initially broken the line had. Instead, they'd simply smashed one ship after another into splintered, all too often burning wreckage. By the time they'd worked their way along half the line, ships were striking their colours before they were even fired upon. Coleman didn't want to think about how Zaspar Clintan was likely to react to that, but no reasonable man could possibly condemn them when they'd seen half their entire navy turned to driftwood in barely 2 hours by a weapon they couldn't possibly match. "I see," he said out loud, then stiffened his spine. "May I ask what message High Admiral Rockpoint has sent you to deliver to me, Admiral Yearly?"
"You may," Yearly said gravely.
"Admiral Rockpoint has sent me to require the surrender of all of your remaining harbour fortifications, your shipyards, sail lofts, rope walks, cannon founderies, and naval supplies."
"That's preposterous!"
The protest exploded out of Coleman before he could stop it, but he glared at the Carizian. "I have a garrison of over 20,000 men in and around this city. You may have defeated, even destroyed our navy, but the army is still fully capable of defending the soil of the Desnarian Empire." Neither Yearly nor the wiry young ensign standing respectfully at his side so much as turned a hair. They simply waited until he'd finished and stood glowering at them, at which point Yearly shrugged very slightly.
"First, Your Grace, your garrison may or may not be able to defend this city. I mean no disrespect to the Imperial Army, but I rather doubt it would find itself as effective against the Imperial Marines and Army battalions
aboard High Admiral Rockpoint's transports as it was against the Republic the last time you clashed with the Sidamachians. Second, however, we have no need to land troops to destroy your shipyards at the very least. Admittedly, the foundries might be somewhat more difficult targets, but I remind you of what happened to your outer fortifications. The Imperial Carisian Navy is fully capable of carrying out the same sort of bombardment of your waterfront batteries and warehouses and, for that matter, the shipyards themselves, without putting a single marine into Ithria. High Admiral Rockpoint has instructed me to point out to you that by requiring the surrenders I've described, he's attempting to minimize the loss of Desnarian life and collateral damage to civilian property. I've had reports of what happened to the first of your ships to engage ours, Admiral, Coleman replied in a chilly tone, and you wouldn't have the advantage of surprise this time around. No doubt you could destroy the shipyards, or damage them severely at any rate with the bombardment, but you wouldn't do it without losses of your own. And I doubt you have the range to bombard the cannon foundries and our other facilities at all. You might be surprised in that regard, Your Grace. Nonetheless, the High Admiral has instructed me to inform you that his terms are not negotiable. The Carisian Admiral's brown eyes looked levelly into Coleman's, and if there was any bluff in them, the Duke couldn't see it. He will destroy those facilities. All of them, before he withdraws from Ithria, Your Grace. The degree and extent of additional damage inflicted is, in large part, up to you. Whether or not he'll succeed in his mission is not. He has a high opinion of himself and his capabilities, doesn't he? Coleman inquired acidly, and Yearly surprised him with a slight smile. I suppose he does, Your Grace. On the other hand, he's earned the right to it, I believe. If you don't think so, you could discuss the matter with Duke Thirsk, or perhaps Bishop Cornelis, or Admiral of the Broad Ocean Sun Rising, or for that matter, his eyes stabbed Coleman suddenly, Baron Jarrus. That's an impressive catalogue of defeated foes, Coleman said in a somewhat milder tone. As it happens, I mean that sincerely. But it's not enough to convince me to simply roll over in the face of such demands. If he believes he can accomplish them by force of arms, I invite him to make the attempt. Your Grace. Any trace of humour had vanished from Yearly's expression and voice. I strongly suggest you reconsider that position. He raised one hand in an oddly courteous gesture before Coleman could respond. I'm speaking for myself, not High Admiral Rockpoint, when I say that, Your Grace. The High Admiral truly is trying to minimize bloodshed and destruction here in your city, but he has no intention of shedding Carisian blood unnecessarily in the attempt. I'm afraid he's going to find it is necessary, Coleman said coldly. I have a duty to my Emperor and to Mother Church. He suppressed an urge to bite his own tongue for the way that came out, as if the church was only an afterthought. I'm responsible for defending this entire city, not simply commanding the naval forces which you've already defeated, Admiral Yearly. Then I'm afraid I have an additional message for you, Your Grace. Yearly's voice was flat now, cold. High Admiral Rockpoint instructs me to inform you that should you choose to force him to bombard and invade your city, he will unfortunately find it necessary to free himself of the distraction of your surrendered vessels and fortresses first. In that event, he'll be forced to burn his prizes and blow up the fortresses. This time Coleman managed not to wince physically. He doubted there was any way the Empire was getting any of those ships back anyway. In fact, it would actually be better from his perspective if Rockpoint did burn them. At least that way he could point out to the group of four that unlike Cornelis Harper's ships, none of his would find their way into Carisian service against Mother Church. "The High Admiral must do as he thinks best," he said. "If he truly intends to burn all of those ships, I'll make arrangements to take off their crews. I'm sure we can arrange a proper parole for them." "I'm afraid you didn't fully understand the High Admiral's position, Your Grace. Under the circumstances, he regrets to point out to you that it won't be possible to land any of his prisoners or remove them from their vessels before he burns their ships."
For an instant, it totally failed to register. Then it did, and Coleman's face went white as the threat sank home. There were almost 30,000 men aboard those ships, and that didn't even count the crews of the floating batteries and the harbour fortresses which had surrendered.
"You can't be serious," he heard his voice say. "On the contrary, Your Grace, the High Admiral is deadly serious."
There was no emphasis at all in Yearley's voice, which made it the most terrible voice the Duke of Coleman had ever heard.
"That's monstrous."
"As monstrous as King Ranald's decision to hand prisoners of war over to the Inquisition, to be systematically tortured and murdered?" Yearley asked softly.
"I had nothing to do with that."
"Perhaps not," Yearley conceded. "But if we'd lost here instead of winning, and if Zaspar Clinton demanded the surrender of your prisoners, do you think for one moment Emperor Mares wouldn't hand them over?" Coleman stared at the Carisian flag officer, sickness churning in his stomach, because he saw the truth looking back at him out of those level brown eyes. Of course the Emperor would have surrendered them to the Inquisition. "I was under the impression it was your empire's position that honorably surrendered prisoners of war would not be abused in that fashion," he said, instead of answering the question.
"Whenever possible, that is indeed Emperor Caleb and Empress Shalian's policy," Yearley replied. "That doesn't mean their armed forces will incur unnecessary casualties, avoiding unfortunate consequences for those taken in arms against us, however. Unlike you, Your Grace, my empire is fighting for its very survival, and you know perfectly well what will happen should we lose. We have no intention of losing, and however much we may regret it, we will do what we must. You talk about arranging parole for your personnel. Do you think we're foolish enough to believe for an instant those paroles would be honored? Of course they wouldn't, even if you fully intended to honor them, and I'll grant you the courtesy of believing you would. The group of four would never permit it. Anyone who tried to honor a parole to the Empire of Caris would be condemned by the Inquisition and probably suffer the punishment of Shula, as a warning to anyone else cowardly enough to entertain such an arrangement. So let's be clear here. If High Admiral Rockpoint returns your personnel to you, you and I both know none of our own surrendered people will ever be returned to us alive, but we will see your people again under arms. He's under no obligation to hand them back to you under those circumstances, but he's prepared to do so in return for the surrender and destruction of the facilities he's listed. Your Emperor and your Empire have agreed to serve the group of four. Perhaps you believe that's the right thing to do. Perhaps you've agreed to serve only because you have no choice. In either case, however the decision was made, and my High Admiral has instructed me to point out to you that decisions have consequences. The consequence of this decision is that you've ranged yourself with our enemies in what, for us, is a war for survival. And the price for your survival and the survival of your men is the destruction of all war-making potential in and around the city of Ithria. Tension hissed and crackled in the office, but somehow Coleman couldn't look away from the Carisian Admiral's eyes. "That's High Admiral Rockpoint's message for you, Your Grace," Yearley said flatly. "I do, however, have an observation of my own to add to it, if you'd care to hear it." Coleman made a curt go-ahead gesture, and the Carisian admiral smiled thinly. It was not a pleasant expression.
"I'd recommend you remember what happened in Farade, Your Grace, and who was in command of that punitive expedition. And for that matter, that there are significant differences between that expedition and today. Unlike the situation which existed in regard to the kingdom of Delphirac at that time, the Dasnarian Empire has formally joined the group of Force Jihad against Karis. And I invite you to remember what the writ itself says about the rules of war where jihad is concerned. Many of those rules are specifically set aside under the provisions of the Book of Shula, and while Karis didn't begin this jihad, we recognize that there comes a point at which the only way to deter outrages against us or our people is to threaten reprisal. As you've pointed out, my emperor and empress have specifically rejected the notion of applying the punishment to any of our prisoners. But they haven't renounced the right to set aside the same rules of war which have been set aside against us. The group of four, excuse me, the Grand Vicar, speaking in the holy name of Mother Church, in his own good judgment, and with the guidance of the archangels. The contempt in Yerli's voice was withering. Has officially declared what's going to happen to Talisberg and Charaeth on the day of our inevitable defeat. I suggest you consider the terms of the destruction your empire has pledged itself to help carry out when you consider High Admiral Rockpoint's offer. By simple reciprocity, this entire city is subject to the same treatment. Which means that if the time comes for High Admiral Rockpoint to abandon his efforts to minimize death and destruction of Desnarian subjects and their property, your entire city could be legitimately burned to the ground with its citizens still in it. He doesn't want to do that, but he will if he must. And the Carisian Admiral's eyes bored into Coleman once more. If he has to begin by burning your ships, then so be it. It was very quiet and still in that office. The silence lingered for at least 30 seconds before it was broken. Then, would you care to reconsider your decision, Your Grace? Sir Duncan Yerley asked softly. September, Year of God, 895. 1. HMS Destiny 54, Tarot Channel, and Talisberg Palace, City of Talisberg, Kingdom of Old Karis. And I have the honour to remain Your Majesty's obedient servant, Sir Duncan Yerley finished, leaning back in his chair with his feet propped on a footstool, long, curved-stemmed pipe in hand, while he gazed out the opened stern windows at HMS Destiny's wake. "Remain Your Majesty's obedient servant," Truman Liwashay repeated softly, the nib of his pen scratching busily. He finished writing and looked up, one eyebrow raised. "What does that leave us, Truman?" Yerley asked, turning his head to look at the secretary. "I believe that's actually just about everything, sir," Liwashay replied after contemplating the deckhead thoughtfully for a moment while he consulted his orderly memory. "I need to check the squadron's medical lists to make sure that portion of your report is up to date, but I think we've actually covered everything at this point." "Remarkable," Yerley said dryly. He took another puff from his pipe, then clamped it between his teeth, climbed out of his chair, and walked over to the stern window, resting both hands on the windowsill, as he looked out across the stern walk at the brilliant blue waters of the Tarot Channel. "You know," he said over his shoulder, never looking away from the water, "back when I was a mere captain, I made the sobering discovery that, contrary to the foolish and romantic belief of more junior officers, The Navy really sailed on paper, not water. Or that getting all of the paperwork done and the forms filled out and the returns properly and accurately, damn their ink-stained little souls, tallied, was obviously more important than simply, oh, training your gunners or exercising aloft at any rate. He shook his head, taking the pipe from his mouth to tamp the tobacco with a thumb while he sighed mournfully. Little did I realize how much more paperwork was lurking in my future the instant I allowed them to give me that damned streamer. Lavoisier chuckled, and Yearly wheeled, putting his back to the windows and pointing an accusatory pipe stem at the younger man. "Don't you laugh, Master Secretary. I know who really invented all these reports and forms. You, and the rest of your kind, that's who. It's all a plot to give employ to people like you. I'm sure if I examine the writ hard enough, I'll find bureaucrat listed somewhere as one of Shanway's major demon familiars." "Alas, you found us out, sir." Lavoisier shook his head, expression sad. "And most of my colleagues thought simple sailors would never tumble to the truth. What gave us away? Was it the creation of the new numbers?" "That was a clue," Yearly said soberly, although his lips twitched as he spoke. "Obviously, just another ploy to generate even more reports for the Admiralty, and especially the Office of Supply." "I warned the others we were reaching too far with that one, sir," Lavoisier said mournfully. "And well you should have," Yearly said roundly. "In fact..." He paused as someone knocked on his cabin door. A moment later, Silvest Ragley poked his head into the after cabin. Lieutenant Aplin Armagh is here, Sir Duncan." "And why is he there?" Yearly inquired, pointing at the open door. "Instead of here?" He pointed at the rug covering the after cabin's deck planking. "Of course, Sir Duncan." The steward smiled and beckoned to the young officer behind him. A moment later, Hector Aplin Armagh, his tunic bearing the single silver cuff star of a lieutenant, stepped into the cabin. "I apologize for interrupting, Sir Duncan," he said, "but the lookout's just spotted Channel Point, fine on the starboard bow. Captain Lathick estimates we should round Cape Thal by dinner time." "Excellent," Yearly smiled, then looked back at Lavoisier. "It would appear we've gotten on top of your nefarious correspondence just in time, Truman. If Captain Lathick's estimate is as reliable as usual, we should be anchored by this time tomorrow. Can you have fair copies of all those dratted reports ready for dispatch by then?" "I believe so, Sir Duncan, although..." The secretary smiled at Aplin Armagh. "I may have to requisition your flag lieutenant's assistance to get it all done in time." "You may, eh?" Yearly snorted. "Well, in that case, put him in charge of writing up my expense report." "With his handwriting? They'll never figure out how much we actually spent." "I'm glad Hector's made it home in one piece again, even if we did miss his birthday," Caleb Armagh said. He and his wife and daughter sat on their private terrace, still tyrannized by Princess Zanet's accursed parrot, enjoying an unusually cool Tellisburg evening, as they watched HMS Destiny through owl snarks. "He hasn't quite made it home yet, love," Charlianne pointed out, and Caleb snorted. "You're the one who keeps telling me that anywhere the Carisian flag flies is just as much Carisian territory as Tellisburg itself," he pointed out. "In fact, for someone who had had the bad taste to be born a Chisholmian, you're almost rabid about the point. And given that Gorja's now a subject monarch of the Empire in good standing, Taro is certainly Carisian territory, so there." He stuck out his tongue, and Charlian shook her head mournfully. "It always amazes me what a soul of perfect tact and unfailing courtesy you are. Just remember, Alana's watching you." The example you set's going to come home to haunt you in just a year or two, and if there's any justice in the world, your daughter's going to grow up to be a female version of you.
God, I hope not.
Caleb shuddered in not entirely feigned dismay at the thought. On the other hand, I'd probably deserve it. I remember Father's most deadly parental curse was always, "May you have children just like mine."
Most parents feel that way, I suspect, Your Majesty, another voice said in Caleb's earplug.
And, speaking as a parent with a little more experience than you or Her Grace have yet achieved, I can tell you you're going to find out it always comes true. Of course, there are good points about that too, especially if you've had the wisdom to pick the right spouse to contribute to the mix.
Charlene laughed and shook her head.
Narman, don't try to convince me you don't dote on all of your children, she accused.
Of course I do, the Emeraldian prince replied from his study in Arestor.
You can't expect me to simply go around admitting that, though, especially not where they're likely to hear it. I can see why Merlin was concerned about my discovering Machiavelli, although, to be fair, I'd already figured out most of it for myself. And the man's cynicism about religion is almost worthy of Clintan himself. But there's never a child born who wasn't a natural Machiavelli where his parents were concerned. The last thing you need to do is give anyone as ruthless and self-centered as a child another handle to manipulate you.
That may be one of the most cynical things I've ever heard anyone say, Caleb observed mildly, and it was Narman's turn to laugh.
I didn't say that he weren't lovable, or loving, for that matter, Your Majesty. I only said children are self-centered and ruthless, and they are. One of the harder tricks, I think, is hammering any other attitude into their brains. Worth it, in the end, but hard. I was luckier than I deserved to be with Falaise, and so far, Narman Gareth's turning up pretty well too, I think. Of course, that's more Olivia's doing than mine. I'm afraid I've been too occupied as a scheming, conniving, ruthless practitioner of real politic to contribute to civilizing them the way I really should have. Still, they are good kids, aren't they?
Yes, they are, Caleb agreed with a smile. And so is young Hector, too. Although now I think about it, he's not as young as he was, is he?
Lieutenant, His Grace, the Duke of Darkos Sound, Charlene repeated with a smile of her own. I'm sure he never saw that coming when he sat for his midshipman's exam.
No, he didn't.
Caleb's smile faded as he recalled how Master Midshipman Applin had become a member of the Carisian royal family.
I didn't mean to bring up an unhappy memory, Caleb, Charlene said softly, and he shook his head quickly.
We've both lost people we love, Charlie. And like Michael always says, losing them is the price we pay for loving them in the first place.
But sometimes we're fortunate enough to find something good coming out of the loss, and that's what Hector is. I'd like to say I could take credit for raising a good son, but his parents get the thanks for that. I'm just grateful he's turning out as well as he is, assuming we can keep him alive, of course.
He and Charlene looked at one another, eyes momentarily dark with memories of the carnage of the Battle of Ithria's opening phases.
We can only try, Caleb, Narman said.
That would be easier for me to say if Narman Garrett weren't getting close to the age when I'm going to have to think about sending him off to sea. But it's true, and I suspect we wouldn't be doing any of them, or any of our subjects, any favours if we tried to keep them safely at home. You already knew what naval service was like because your father sent you off to sea at first hand, and that's been incredibly valuable to all of us over the last few years. For that matter, the tradition that privilege has to be earned by service is one any ruler ought to learn early. And one, I'm ashamed to admit, I learned at a rather later point in life than you did. There's a lot to be said for that Carisian tradition of yours when you come down to it. I don't want to see my son traumatized the way Hector was at Duck or Sound, but I do want him to understand the reality of what war costs and what it's really all about. And if he turns into half the young man your Hector is, I'll be proud to be his father." Caleb and Charlian looked at each other again, and this time their eyes had softened and warmed. It wasn't often, even now, that Narman Bates let anyone far enough inside his armour to see his heart within it. There'd been a time when Caleb would have been prepared to argue he didn't have one to be seen, but not any more. "Well," the Emperor said more briskly, intentionally shifting the subject, "now that Hector and Admiral Yearly, of course, are this close to home, we'll be able to start taking official cognizance of what happened at Ithria. Have you had any more thoughts on that, Narman?"
"Not really, Your Majesty."
There was an edge of amusement in Narman's voice as he recognized Caleb's deliberate return to greater formality. Then his tone sobered. "The really interesting question is how Clintan and the rest of the group of four are going to react, especially to Coleman's and Jarrah's decision to emigrate. That is going to piss him off, isn't it?" Caleb's smile was unpleasant. "Not that he has anyone but himself to blame for it." Charlian nodded in grim agreement. They still weren't going to officially know about that until Rockpoint himself reached home, since Destiny had been sent off as soon as she'd been able to step a replacement mainmast. Partly that was because Thaenair wanted to get his initial dispatches home as quickly as possible, but it was also because Destiny, like the other ships in company with her, had damage that was going to take a dockyard to put right. Yearly's flagship had been severely holed below the waterline before St. Adolfo and Loyal Defender struck their colours, and Master Margale and his carpenter's mates hadn't been able to find, or plug at any rate, all of the leaks. Destiny's pumps were working for over 20 minutes in each watch to keep the slow flooding under control, and he'd wanted her in dockyard hands as quickly as possible, so he'd sent her off while Duke Coleman was still struggling with the harshness of the Imperial Corisian Navy's terms. In the end, the Duke had decided against calling Dominic Stainer's bluff. That had probably been wise of him, since Charlian wasn't at all sure Dominic had been bluffing. The High Admiral's patience with those who served the group of four had grown increasingly thin as reports of what was happening to Gwilym Manthir and his people leaked out of Zion. Charlian didn't think Rockpoint would actually have burned his surrendered prisoners alive in their own ships. He was Michael Stainer's brother, when all was said. But she never doubted for a moment that he would have bombarded however much of the city he had had to take out his assigned targets, which would have been quite bad enough. Fortunately, he hadn't had to. Coleman had bowed to the inevitable, ordered Ithria's garrison to withdraw from the city, and allowed Rockpoint's marines and army battalions to land unopposed. In return, Rockpoint had taken stringent precautions to minimize civilian casualties or injuries. There'd still been a couple of incidents with Temple loyalists who'd attempted to ambush Corisian detachments. Desnarian casualties had been close to 100% in those instances. Although Rockpoint's shore commanders had kept their men under iron control to prevent things from getting out of hand, they might have found it easier to maintain that kind of control because of the intense satisfaction their men took in the systematic destruction of anything in Ithria that could have contributed to the Desnarian war effort. Every gun had been loaded with quadruple charges and 4 or 5 round shot and fired until its tube split, then dumped into the harbour. Every battery emplacement and powder magazine had been blown up. The shipyards and sawmills and sail lofts and rope walks, which had built and rigged Baron Jarrah's galleons, had been put to the torch. Thousands of tons of naval supplies, seasoned timbers, acres of canvas, hundreds of thousands of feet of cordage, endless barrels of turpentine, paint, pitch, varnish, linseed oil, oakum, thousands of bags of biscuit and tons of preserved meat and vegetables, had gone up in thick, choking columns of dense black smoke. Huge stocks of muskets, cutlasses, pikes and pistols had been seized and lighted out to the waiting Carisian transport galleons. Several hundred thousand roundshot had been loaded aboard barges and hulks, towed into deep water, and then sent to the bottom. All five of the cannon founderies around the city had been blown up, most of the waterfront warehouses had been burned to the ground, and every one of the surviving fortresses on the islands dotted about the gulf had been thoroughly demolished. The millions upon millions of marks the Church of God Awaiting and the Disnarian Empire had invested in turning Ithria into one of the anchors of the Group of Four's naval power had disappeared in those roaring flames and rivers of smoke, and Coleman had realized what that meant for him personally. When Sir Dominic Stainer landed his prisoners, without even attempting to secure the paroles he knew they would never be allowed to honour, the Duke of Coleman and every member of his immediate family had joined Baron Jarrus aboard HMS Destroyer. Along with the rest of Stainer's fleet, the fugitives were perhaps a 5 day and a half behind destiny. You know they're never going to admit Coleman and his family were driven into seeking asylum because of Clintan's vindictiveness, Charlian said. And it won't matter what Coleman and Jarrus have to say either. Not as far as the Group of Four's propaganda is concerned, no, Caleb agreed. On the other hand, that's not the only propaganda circulating in Haven. No, Your Majesty, Narman agreed cheerfully, and I'll bet Clintan's frothing at the mouth trying to figure out where those heretical printing presses are. To be honest, one of the things I most regret about Merlin's inability to put snarks inside the temple is the fact that I can't actually watch his blood pressure rise when Reno makes his reports on that front. All three of them laughed, but he had a point, Caleb thought. The Inquisition was searching with grim determination for the printers distributing the propaganda broadsheets, which somehow, mysteriously, kept circulating throughout the various mainland realms. Unfortunately for the Inquisition, while there truly were a handful of mainland reformists running very small presses, the stealthed remotes, which actually distributed the overwhelming majority of the offending broadsheets, were just a bit hard to spot. Every day the Inquisition ripped those broadsheets down from one wall or another in virtually every mainland city. Every night, Owl's remotes put them back up on different walls in completely different neighbourhoods. And no one ever saw a thing. The one place they were careful about not distributing propaganda like that was the Republic of Sidamark. Sidamark had by far the largest community of Carisian expatriates, and the situation there was becoming increasingly tense. No one in Caris wanted to add any additional sparks to such a potentially incendiary mixture, which, unfortunately, didn't prevent a growing number of people inside Sidamark from distributing their own propaganda. Worse, the reformist movement was steadily gathering strength in the Sidamarkian church, and no one this side of God had any idea where that was going to lead. I'm sure those mysterious, shameless propagandists and vile enemies of Mother Church will capitalize on these defections, Caleb continued with a pious expression. And I suspect that's going to have a greater effect than Clintan or the Inquisition want to think about. But I'm more interested in what it's going to do from our perspective. His expression turned much more serious. I know it sounds mushy-headed and soft-hearted, but I've always wanted Caris to be a genuine refuge, a place that welcomes people fleeing from intolerance or oppression or persecution. That's got to be the real basis for everything we're trying to build, the foundation for human freedom and human dignity. And to stand against something like the Church and someone like Clintan That foundation has to be firm. It has to have roots sunk into bedrock, deep enough to weather any storm. And for that to really work, Carizzians have to see themselves that way. Our people have to define themselves as welcoming refugees from persecution, if we don't want those refugees to become, what was that word Merlin used? Ghettoized. That was it. Unless we want those refugees to settle in isolated, undigested chunks instead of being integrated into the society and the church around them, we need to embrace them. And we need the foundation set now, before we have to start dealing with telling the entire world the truth about Langhorne and the other archangels. People like Madame Dynas or Father Pater's family are a visible proof to everyone, including our own people, that that's the way it works, the way we really think, at least here in Caris, by God. And for that matter, you and Gorgia are proof we're even willing to become old enemies and actually integrate them into our own society and government if they're willing to stand up beside us against people like the Group of Four, Narmon. Now we've got a chance to do the same thing with Jarrah and Coleman, and I damn well want to see it handled the right way. Charlian nodded, leaning closer to rest her head on his shoulder, while they watched Alana scurrying around the terrace on hands and knees. "We're working on it, love," she told him. "We're working on it." 2. Grey Wyvern Avenue, City of Tellersburg, Kingdom of Old Caris. It was a handsome freight wagon, if he did say so himself, Ainsel Danvar thought. He'd spent a lot of effort on it, and the fact that he was a skilled carpenter and wagon maker had played a prominent part in the planning for his part of Operation Rakurai. He was sure others among the Grand Inquisitor's Rakurai had skills of their own, which had been factored into Archbishop Willem's planning and orders, although no one had ever told him that. He understood why that was, of course. What he didn't know couldn't be tortured out of him if he had the misfortune to be captured alive by the heretics. To be fair, which he didn't really want to do, he had to admit he'd seen no overt evidence the heretics hadn't meant it when they promised not to torture their enemies. But what happened in the open wasn't always the same as what happened in secret, and the heretic's success in picking off every effort to build some kind of effective organization against them certainly suggested they were forcing people to talk somehow. But however they were managing it, it wouldn't do them any good if he didn't have the information they wanted in the first place. And it wasn't going to matter a great deal longer one way or the other, he reminded himself. "It'd be a lot simpler if we could just go ahead and unload the wagon, Master Gaston," the wheelwright said, surveying the broken wheel and cracked axle. "Get the weight off it, and we could jack it up a lot easier." "I know it would," the man who called himself Hiram Gaston agreed with a nod. "And if you see some place to park another wagon this size while we shift the load to it, I'm all for it." He waved his hands with an exasperated expression, and the wheelwright grimaced in acknowledgement. Grey Wyvern Avenue was one of the busiest streets in Tellersburg, a city famous for the density of its traffic. Gaston had been doing well to get his 8-wheeled articulated wagon dragged to the side of the street after the right front wheel broke. To accomplish even that much, he'd had to crowd up onto the sidewalk, and the foot traffic's need to flow around it wasn't doing a thing to ease the congestion. Now the hill dragon between the shafts stood patiently, head down, while it rummaged through the feed bag hung from its head, ignoring the even more constricted traffic oozing past the obstruction. The city guard had already made it clear they wanted this particular wagon fixed, quickly, and out of the way before the traffic jam got any worse. "Well," the Carizzian said now, turning with his hands on his hips to watch as his apprentice managed to squeeze their work wagon in behind Gaston's stalled vehicle. "I reckon we'll just have to do the best we can." He shook his head. I'm not sure how well it's going to work if that axle's as bad as it looks, but I think we've got a spare wheel we can change out at least long enough to tow you out of the middle of all this damn traffic.
Good, Ainsel said, nodding enthusiastically, and rolled his eyes.
If I have one more irritated guardsman wander by to ask me, how much longer do you think you'll be? I think I'll just go ahead and cut my throat right here.
That seems a mite drastic to me, the wheelwright told him with a grin. Still and all, you're close enough to the cathedral, you could probably get in line with the archangels pretty quick.
He laughed, and Ainsel made himself laugh back, although there wasn't anything funny about the blasphemous reference as far as he was concerned. And he noticed the heretic didn't sign himself with the scepter when he mentioned the archangels either. Well, it was hardly a surprise. He stepped back and watched the wheelwright and his assistant get to work. They were good, he admitted, as Carisian workmen tended to be. But they were in for a surprise. Well, two surprises, if he was going to be accurate, although they probably wouldn't have time to appreciate the second one. But that spare wheel of theirs wasn't going to fit. Ansel had taken some pains to make sure no standard Carisian wheel hub was going to fit that axle, just as he had very carefully arranged for the wheel to break precisely where and when it had. Fortunately, no one had noticed the sharp rap with the hand sledge, which had been required to knock out the wedge he'd fitted to keep the wheel rim properly tensioned against the steel tire, until he reached exactly the right spot. Hopefully the wheelwright wasn't going to notice that the brake was suspiciously straight-edged and clean, either. Ainsel was a little worried about that, but only a little. God wouldn't have let him come this far, only to fail at this point.
"You worry too much, Regis," Bishop Henrik Wegner said teasingly. "If it weren't the Gulf of Jaras, it would be something else. Admit it. You're a fuss budget."
The white-haired, clean-shaven Bishop of Tellersberg leaned forward to tap an index finger on Duke Greyharbor's chest, brown eyes gleaming with amused challenge. He and Greyharbor had known one another almost as long as Greyharbor had known Michael Stainer, and Wegner, as the second-ranking prelate of the Church of Caris, often sat in for the Archbishop on meetings of the Imperial Council, when Stainer, as today, was otherwise occupied with responsibilities of his own ecclesiastic office.
"I am not a fuss budget," Greyharbor said with immense dignity as the carriage moved steadily along the street. "I'm simply a conscientious, thoughtful, insightful, don't forget insightful, servant of the Crown. It's my job to worry about things, just like it's your job to reassure me that God is on our side."
"Insightful?" Wegner snorted. "Is that what you call it?"
"When I don't feel an even stronger term is appropriate, yes," Greyharbor said judiciously, and the bishop laughed.
"I guess there might be a little something to that," he said, holding up a thumb and forefinger of his right hand, perhaps a quarter of an inch apart. "A little something." His eyes glinted at his old friend. "Still, with Dominic in command and Sajan Merlin's visions assuring us everything went well, can't you find something better to worry about than the Gulf of Jaras?"
Greyharbor considered for a moment, then shrugged. "Of course I can. In fact, I think probably one reason I'm worrying about the Gulf is that we do know it worked out well."
Wegner looked perplexed, and Greyharbor chuckled.
"What I mean is that worrying about something I know worked pretty much the way we had in mind distracts me from worrying about the other some things out there that we don't know are going to work out the way we have in mind, if you take my meaning.
You know, the frightening thing is that I do understand you," Wegner said. "Probably says something unhealthy about my own mind."
Greyharbor chuckled again, louder, and the bishop shook his head at him. The truth was, of course, that both of them knew about the good news Greyharbor was going to be able to announce in the next 5 days or so. Wegner, as a member of the inner circle, had actually watched the battle through owl's remotes for several hours.
He'd spent most of that time praying for the thousands of men who were being killed or maimed in that cauldron of smoke and fire and exploding ships. And he knew exactly what price Dominic Stainer's fleet had paid to purchase that victory. Grey Harbour hadn't been able to watch personally, but the First Counsellor was an experienced naval officer, with first-hand experience of what that sort of carnage was like. And he had long since grown accustomed to take in Merlin's visions as demonstrated fact. He'd been planning how best to use the destruction of the Disnarian navy ever since the battle had been fought, and he was looking forward to putting those plans into motion as soon as the news officially reached Tellisberg. "The problem's not with your mind, Henrik," Grey Harbour told him now. "The problem's with..." Ainsel stood on the narrow, constricted space of open sidewalk beside his wagon, between it and the building he had managed to park alongside, and watched the traffic flow past while the wheelwright and his apprentice swore with feeling and inventiveness. They'd just discovered the non-standard dimensions of the wagon axle, and as soon as the two of them got done expressing their feelings, Ainsel was sure they'd get around to working out ways to deal with the problem. Or they would have, if they'd had time, he thought, as he finally spotted the vehicle he'd been waiting for. It was a good thing he had made sure the repairs were going to be more time-consuming than the wheelwright had originally thought, since the carriage, making its way slowly along the crowded street, was substantially behind its regular schedule. And, as it drew closer, Ainsel felt his mouth tighten in disappointment. He was accompanied by the guardsman in the orange and white livery of the Archbishop, who normally escorted it. "Why today?" he demanded silently. "Today, of all days. Would it have been too much to ask for the bastard to keep to his own?" He cut that thought off quickly. The fact that God and Langhorne had seen fit to bring him this far, grant him the degree of success he had achieved, was more than any man had a right to demand. He had no business complaining or berating God just because he hadn't been given still more. "Forgive me," he prayed humbly as he opened the small, carefully concealed panel he'd built into the side of the wagon bed. "It's not my place to set my wisdom above yours. I'm sure it's all part of your plan. Thank you for the opportunity to be part of your work." He reached into the hidden compartment and cocked the flintlock. Then his hand settled around the pistol grip, and he stood, shoulders relaxed, watching with a calm tranquillity he was a little surprised to realize was completely genuine, as the carriage rolled steadily closer. "We're going to have to go back to the shop, Master Gaston," the wheelwright was saying. "It looks like we'll need to..." He went on talking, but Ainsel tuned him out. He nodded, pretending he was listening, but his attention was on another voice. His mother's voice, reciting the catechism with a much younger Ainsel as he sat on her lap in her kitchen. And then there was Archbishop Willem's voice, and other voices, all with him at this moment, bearing him up on their strength. He listened to them, embraced them, and as the carriage drew even with the wagon, Ainsel Danbar smiled joyously and squeezed the trigger. 3. Tellisberg Palace, City of Tellisberg, Kingdom of Old Claris, and Cathedral Square, City of Erastor, Princedom of Emerald, Empire of Claris.
"I came as quickly as I could, Caleb," Michael Stainer said as a stone-faced Edward Seahamper escorted him into the royal couple's private chambers.
The Archbishop crossed the room quickly and knelt beside Charlian, who sat hunched in a chair, clasping her daughter in her arms while tears ran down her cheeks. Caleb only nodded curtly as Stainer put a comforting arm around Charlian's shoulders. There were no tears in his eyes, only fury, and the Archbishop hid a stab of concern as he recognized his Emperor's rage. "There's only so much provocation any man can take before he starts forgetting he's not the kind of animal his opponents are," Stainer thought quietly. "Please, Caleb,
please, step back from this. Draw a deep breath. Don't lash out in some way you'll regret in days to come.
We should have taken more precautions, the Emperor grated. We were too predictable. They knew where to find you and Regis, Michael. That's what this is all about. The only reason they managed to pull it off, they knew where to find you, because we let you use the same route every time you come to the palace.
Caleb, Stainer began, but Caleb cut him off.
No, it's not your fault, the Emperor glared at him. No, you didn't tell your driver or your escort to take alternate routes, but neither did anyone else. Neither did Merlin, and neither did I. And we damn well should have.
Damn it to hell, Michael.
We know Clintan thinks assassination's a perfectly acceptable tool. And unlike you, Narman, he said to the distant Prince of Emerald, he doesn't give a spider-rat's ass how many innocent bystanders he kills along the way. Hell, there aren't any innocent bystanders. Either they're fucking heretics who deserve whatever the hell they get, or else they're noble martyrs to God's plan. Either way, he can kill however the hell many of them he wants in God's name and feel nothing but the satisfaction of a job well done.
Stainer winced. Not because he disagreed with a single thing Caleb had just said, but because of the magma-like fury that filled every syllable.
Caleb, he began again, only to be stopped by a choppy wave of the Emperor's hand. Caleb turned away, fists clenched at his sides, as he glared out a window and fought for self-control. His eyes didn't see the peaceful garden outside his window. They were watching the imagery projected on his contact lenses as Merlin and a party of Imperial Guardsmen worked their way through the bloody wreckage of Grey Wyvern Avenue. There must have been at least a ton of gunpowder in that wagon, he thought bitterly. Where the fuck did they get their hands on that? And how in hell did they get it into Telesburg? And how did none of us spot them at it? He already knew Merlin was going to blame himself for it, just as he blamed himself. But his brain, unlike his emotions, knew both of them would be wrong. They weren't the only ones with access to Ull's snarks, and responsibility for surveillance here in Old Caris lay primarily with Bin Zamin Reis, with Prince Narman as his backup. Both of them were undoubtedly already savaging themselves over what had happened, but Caleb knew exactly what their procedures were, the sort of information they had access to, and he couldn't think of a single thing they could have done differently. "What's the latest death toll estimate?" he said out loud, his voice flat, never turning from the window.
"I don't think anyone knows," Stainer replied quietly.
"Bin Zamin is at St. Masary's. It's chaos there, of course, and I ought to be there, not here."
Caleb turned his head just long enough to stab a single glance at the Archbishop, then returned to the window again. There was no way in the universe he was going to allow Michael Stainer outside the confines of Telesburg Palace until they had a far better handle on what had just happened. Stainer looked at his rigid, unyielding spine for a long moment, then sighed.
"As I say, it's chaos," he continued. "So far they've admitted over 36 patients, and they're sending the less badly hurt to some of the smaller hospitals. How many of the ones they're keeping are going to live?"
He shrugged helplessly.
St. Masary's Hospital was the main hospital of the Order of Pasquale in Telesburg. Only 6 blocks from Telesburg Palace, the savage attack had happened almost outside the enormous complex's front door. That was the one mitigating aspect of this entire murderous day, because St. Masary's had the finest healers and the best surgeons in all of Old Caris. But despite all the medical knowledge and healing liturgies tucked away in the Book of Pasquale, St. Masary's was no trauma centre. Those healers would do the best they could, but they were going to lose a heartbreaking percentage of the maimed and broken bodies which had inundated them.
"Merlin says they've already confirmed at least 200 dead on site," Narman Bates said from Erastor. He and Princess Olivia had been visiting his uncle Hanbil, the Duke of Solomon, when the attack occurred. Now their carriage was on its way back to their palace, and Olivia was pressed tightly against his side, her face resting on his shoulder.
"I don't want to distract him by pestering him with questions at the moment," the chubby little Emeraldian continued flatly. "So I don't have a better count than that. I'm sure there are more bodies, or parts of them anyway, waiting to be found, though."
"Midday on Grey Wyvern Avenue." He barked a harsh, angry laugh that was more than half snarl. "We're going to be lucky if the final count doesn't top 300. And you're right, Caleb. They couldn't have pulled this off if we hadn't let ourselves get too predictable."
"I don't think that was the only reason they got away with it," Charlian said, raising her head as she cuddled a silent, big-eyed Alana against her shoulder. The little girl didn't have a clue what was going on, but she was obviously sensitive to the emotions of the adults around her.
"What do you mean?" Caleb asked, raising an eyebrow at her.
"I mean our confidence turned around and bit us in the arse, as Merlin might put it," she said. "We know what an advantage we have with the Snarks and with Owl to manage them for us. Oh, we also know things can leak through, like what happened in Manchia, for example. But despite that, we know we still have better security than anyone else in the entire world, right?"
"You're saying we let ourselves be lulled into overconfidence," Caleb shrugged.
"That's the same reason we let ourselves get too predictable, Charlie."
"No, that's not what I'm saying. Or it's not everything I'm saying, anyway." Charlian drew a deep breath.
"I guess what I really mean is that we know what an advantage we have. But sometimes we forget the other side's figuring it out, too. They're finding ways to work around it. And we didn't expect them to."
There was silence for a moment, and then Narman nodded as his carriage began making its way through the heavier traffic in Charaeth.
"Like they did with that misinformation about which way Harper was actually going to be sent with his fleet, you mean?" he asked.
"I think yes," she replied. "But this goes further than that." She was obviously working her way through her own analysis as she spoke, and Caleb folded his arms across his chest, watching her intently. And that was more passive, or defensive, perhaps. "It was misinformation, as you said, Narman. This is something a lot more active. They've managed to get whoever put that wagon in position into Tellisburg, and they managed to provide him with the gunpowder he needed, and we never saw a thing, not a thing. How did they do that? How could they build an organization that could coordinate something like that without us seeing a thing?"
"They couldn't," Caleb said slowly, and she nodded. "Which is why I don't think they did anything of the sort," she said flatly. "I don't know how, but God knows the Inquisition's been managing spies and informants and agents, provocateurs, forever. And Clintown already proved in Manchia that he could engineer the assassination of a reigning prince without anyone catching him at it. They managed to get this assassin and his weapon into position somehow too, and the only way I can think of for them to have done that without our catching them at it is to organize it the same way they must have organized their misinformation gambit before the Markovian Sea. They planned it and put it together inside the temple, where we can't get Snarks in to snoop on them," Narman said. "That's what you're saying. And because they've figured out our spies are better than theirs, even if they don't have a clue why that's true, they sent their man in unsupported."
"Unsupported by anyone he had to contact here, anyway," Charlian corrected. "I don't think there's any way anyone could have set this all up on his own after he was here. There had to be some spadework before they sent him in. But I'll bet you any contact with anyone here in Tellisburg or Old Caris went through the temple, not through anyone else here. Limiting themselves to communications channels that go directly from one person back to the temple, and then from the temple back to that one person." Caleb could have sounded dismissive, but he didn't, and his expression was thoughtful. "How in hell could they pull that off?"
"That depends on how willing they'd be to use things like the semaphore system and ciphers,"
Narman responded. We're still using it to communicate with Sidamark and Silkia. In fact, we're allowing greater access to it than the church ever did. So if they feel confident of their cipher system, they could be sending their correspondence back and forth that way easily enough. For that matter, we are not the only people with messenger wyverns, Caleb. The Emeraldian shook his head. That'd be slow and cumbersome and not very responsive, but they could have set up a system that would do the job without ever going near the semaphore. The key point isn't how they get messages back and forth, though. It's the point Charlie's raised. The probability that they're sending out solo operatives. Our ability to detect them depends in large part on Owl's ability to recognize key words in conversation and direct our attention to the people who used them, or on our ability to identify one agent and then work outward until we've found all the members of his network. A single assassin, especially one who's prepared or even eager to die in the attempt the way this fellow certainly was, is going to be one hell of a lot harder to spot and stop. That's true, Caleb agreed, rubbing his chin thoughtfully. On the other hand, a single assassin's going to be able to do a lot less damage than a full-blown conspiracy if we can keep the bastard away from wagon loads of gunpowder. And nothing anyone's brought up so far suggests how they got that big load of explosives through our customs inspections. If they're avoiding building or working with a large organization, then surely they wouldn't have tried to bribe the inspectors. And I doubt they'd use smugglers if they're worried about the potential for being betrayed to the authorities. So how? He broke off suddenly, eyes narrowing in thought. Then he grunted angrily and slammed his right fist into his left palm. Hey, Ratha, he said flatly. That's what that damned explosion was about. They didn't smuggle the gunpowder into Telisberg from one of the mainland realms. They used our gunpowder.